Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design, thoughtful construction, and little details that make life in your space easier. And now they're bringing that comfort and style outside with their outdoor collection. Burrow's outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry stain-resistant foam cushions. As always, you get free shipping on every order. Get 15% off at burrow.com/acast. burrow.com/acast.
Hi everyone, welcome to Dan Snow's History Hit. We're talking about the First World War this time. We're talking about the First World War, but we're talking about the home front, Britain in the First World War, the politics, society in Britain, as it was waging this gigantic, this colossal conflict, several theatres around the world. I've got Simon Heffer on the pod. He is a giant of the British media scene, journalist, writer, and he's turned his attention now to this subject. It was great getting him on the podcast, talking about what he made of Lloyd George, Asquith, and the other politicians who ran Britain at the time, and what Britain had to endure in terms of aerial bombardment and blockade. If you want to watch any documentaries about the First World War, we've got loads. Honestly, we've got lots of documentaries about the First World War. All of your First World War needs will be met at History Hit TV. It's like Netflix, but it just does history. If you use the code POD1, it's exclusive, people listening to this podcast, POD1, you get a month for free and 1 month for just £1, euro or dollar. Just go and check it out. You're not going to believe your eyes. And get your historical face covering at historyhit.com/shop. Get your face covered when you go to the shops, when you go out in public, when you can't social distance, get your face covered, protect other people from coronavirus, and do so with a historical face covering. You want a Habsburg chin? You can buy one on that site. It's pretty sweet. In the meantime, everyone, here is Simon Heffer. Simon, great to have you on the podcast. Thank you for coming on.
Well, thank you for asking me.
Staring at God. I mean, it's such a striking title for a history of the Great War. Where did you get that from?
Well, I was rootling one afternoon a couple of years ago through Mrs. Asquith's papers in the Bodleian Library and reading her diary, which is quite a brilliant document, actually, for anyone interested in this period. And at the end of October 1914, she suddenly realised that she had been wrong, like so many other Britons, that the war wasn't going to be over by Christmas. She'd had this conversation about 10 weeks earlier with Lord Kitchener, the day after he was appointed war secretary, and Kitchener had warned her that the war would last for 3 or 4 years, and she didn't believe him. And suddenly, at the end of October, with various of her friends' sons dying on the Western Front, she realised that something really terrible was happening and was going to continue to happen. And she referred in her diaries to seeing this whole generation blown to pieces by shrapnel, while, as she put it, we are left here staring at God. And I came across that line in the manuscript, and I thought, that is the title of my book, because it really sums up the sheer hopelessness and ghastliiness of that war in the way that it confronted the British people after that initial surge of sort of jingoistic Rupert Brooke-style patriotism that was prevalent in August and September.
It's interesting that you've chosen to write about Britain during the First World War. You felt there were, I suppose, there's so much focus on the battlefields of the war and not enough about what was actually going on at home.
Well, I agree. I read one really good book on Britain during the Great War, which was Jerry de Groot's Blighty, which came out in the mid-1990s. Blighty's an exceptional book, but Jerry had about, a third to a half of the word count that I was allowed by my very generous publisher. And I wanted to go quite deeply into the politics of the war, which are profoundly interesting and which really changed the whole political landscape of the country for decades to come, but also into the privations that were inflicted upon so-called ordinary people during the war. You know, we didn't have the Blitz that we had in the Second World War. We didn't have rationing in the way that we had it in the Second World War. But everybody, in the end, ended up being involved in the war, even to the extent that school children, by the last couple of autumns of the war, were asked to go and collect conkers because the chestnuts that they collected, while inedible by humans, could be eaten by pigs, and therefore the food that was being fed to pigs could be reconstituted and saved for human beings to eat. So everybody, men, women and children, were involved in this war, and I felt that their stories simply hadn't been told adequately.
Do you trace, I mean, how important, let's talk about the politics first, how important is the First World War on the domestic politics of Britain and the development of the modern executive?
Well, of course, Lloyd George, when he becomes Prime Minister in 1916, invents the Cabinet Secretariat. There hadn't been a Cabinet Secretary. Cabinets hadn't had agendas until then. And he has a much smaller war cabinet and delegates more and takes less account of Parliament. He leaves it to Bonar Law, his deputy, to do the boring stuff about going to Parliament and making statements, while Lloyd George either sits in his office thinking great thoughts or goes and glads hand people on the front or in factories, or indeed spends an undue amount of time with his mistress. So that's, in that sense, the neglect of Parliament by prime ministers, which is a common theme through the 20th century, begins with Lloyd George. But I think more interestingly than what it does to the executive, the First World War effectively kills the Liberal Party. And we've just been through this great era of Liberal dominance. I mean, this book is the third in a series of what will be four books that I'm writing about English history from the late 1830s to the Second World War. And in the first two volumes, and indeed in the first half of this volume, you see the almost inconquerable power of the Liberal Party, of Gladstone, of Rosebery, of Campbell-Bannerman and of Asquith. And partly because of Asquith's mismanagement of the party in the first half of the war, but also because of Lloyd George's ambition and his determination to be Prime Minister and to have power at all costs, the Liberal Party is effectively dead by 1922. And given how many years it had spent in power and how much it had achieved, that was quite an astonishing result, to be replaced, of course, by the Labour Party. And so that's the real effect it has on the rest of the 20th century, right up to our own times, that the Tory Party in one form or another survives, but the Labour Party becomes the party, first of all, of opposition, and then in 1924, for the first time, a party of government.
That's connected with the changes of the franchise as much as political misjudgment by Lloyd George and or the Asquith branch, would you say?
I don't know about that. I mean, Mrs. Pankhurst famously, when she got the vote, voted Conservative. And so the argument that all these women came in, of course, women over the age of 30, women under the age of 30 didn't get the vote till 1928, and voted for the Labour Party, I think is slightly fallacious. What really helped the Labour Party was utter disunity in the Liberal Party and an almost tribal sense by people in the industrial working class who, since they got the vote in 1867, had voted usually for the Liberal Party, suddenly said, no, we have to vote for the Labour Party. The Conservative Party does not represent our interests, whereas the Labour Party does. And of course, the Labour Party was quite lucky in 1924 that it had, as one of its leading ministers, as its Lord Chancellor, Lord Haldane, who had been a great figure in the Asquith government.
And so what is it about that great realignment? Why does that happen in that case?
Well, Lloyd George issues a coupon, as it was called by Asquith, in fact, in 1918, of approved candidates for the general election. And the candidates of which he approves are candidates who have supported him unfailingly since he became Prime Minister in 1916, or if they weren't in Parliament, people who have signed up to his beliefs. Now, most of Asquith's old Liberal Party that was in Parliament supported Asquith, and they lost heavily. The Liberal Party was reduced to about 59, I think, seats. It was absolutely thrashed in that election. And there was a big as in 1931 and 1935, there was a big coalition government, which, although led by a liberal, was largely composed of conservatives. And that government went on to 1922 until the Tories fell out with Lloyd George and with some of those Tories who supported Lloyd George, and they ended the coalition. But by that stage, the Liberal Party, because it was so divided and largely had been booted out of Parliament, was not an electoral force. It managed to win a few dozen seats in 1922, 23, 24, that series of elections. But really, by the time you get to the mid-1920s, it's no longer a serious electoral force. And indeed, by 1929, when the Labour Party manages to win over 200 seats and form a government and to govern for a couple of years until the effects of the Depression get on it, even then, the Liberal Party can't use Labour's misfortune in government to revive. And they effectively go where they were for the rest of the 20th century.
So you've got political realignment in Britain. You've got huge expansion of the franchise. You've got some institutional change. What other domestic... How else did the First World War change Britain itself?
Well, I think the greatest change was for women. Because apart from getting the franchise... Well, look at the reasons that Asquith stated in, I think, late 1916, just before he ceased to be Prime Minister, about why he had suddenly changed his mind after decades of opposing women's suffrage to supporting it. He recognised, as did everybody else in their right mind in this country, that without the wholehearted support of women, we would have lost the Great War. Everybody thinks the Women's Land Army was started in the Second World War. Well, it wasn't. It was started in the Great War. And there were an enormous number of women working on the land by 1916. And if they hadn't been there, we would have starved, quite simply, because so many farm labourers had been taken off to the army. And many of the ships that were bringing in our food from North America were being sunk by U-boats. And so, first of all, women proved their worth in that they literally fed the nation. Second, women became the majority of the workforce in arms factories and munitions factories. While some highly specialised men were allowed to avoid the draft and stay in factories to make munitions, most men working in munitions factories at the start of the war, and there weren't that many factories, by the way, we were very under-equipped in that line, they were put to the army. The factories that were opened were largely staffed by women. The factories where men had been taken to the war, those men were replaced by women. And that also ignores the fact that, as well as working on the land or working in factories, women were very seriously engaged in bringing up children in the absence of their husbands and fathers. And so they were actually the linchpin of society in the Great War. And so when the war ends and all these men come home from the army and demobilisation takes place, suddenly women are told, well, OK, you've done your bit, now go back to hearth and home and bring up your families. And many women didn't accept that. They said, no, we've learned how to be independent. We've had jobs, we've made money, we've looked after ourselves, and we want to go back to work. And women would never again be the sort of downtrodden species that so many of them were, sadly, before the Great War. And that, to me, is the greatest transformation of this country. And it had the widest effect in the rest of the century.
How did Hitler's sexuality shape his worldview? Why did the Black Death lead to the rise of the witch trials? And what are some of the sauciest scandals involving kings and queens at Hampton Court? I don't know about you, but this is the history I want to hear about. If you do too, then join me, Kate Lister, every Tuesday and Friday to find out the answers to all of these questions and more. Listen to Betwixt the Sheets, the History of Sex Scandal in Society, wherever you get your podcasts. Brought to you by History Hit.
How's it? My name is Les Eddy. I'm a tour leader with Explore. Come on, let me show you something. Oh, careful. Can you see it? Oh, trust me. It can see you. There, between the trees. It's not every day you get to see a rhino on a walk. I guess not everyone is taken to the right places. But you will be, if you explore. For global adventures, search exploreworldwide.com and don't just travel. Explore.
Looking for the perfect gift to celebrate the moms in your life? Aura frames are beautiful, Wi-Fi connected digital picture frames that allow you to share and display unlimited photos. It's super easy to upload and share photos via the Aura app. And if you're giving an Aura as a gift, you can even personalize the frame with preloaded photos and memories. And also remember, when using messaging apps, they shrink the photos. You cannot print those out. You cannot blow them up. This is high quality imagery going to one of the most important people in your life. The Aura app is super easy to set up. It takes about 2 minutes and you're going to love it. There's free unlimited storage, add unlimited photos and videos, and invite as many people as you want to a frame. Right now, Aura has got a great deal for Mother's Day. Listeners can save on the perfect gift by visiting auraframes.com to get $30 plus free shipping on their best-selling frame. That's A-U-R-A-Frames.com. Use code DANSNOW at checkout to save. Terms and conditions apply.
In that case, let's come back now to the experience of conflict. You mentioned there was no blitz. There was, of course, sustained aerial strategic bombing for the first time on British towns and cities. That wasn't to be brushed off. I mean, there were some very serious casualties, weren't there?
Oh, yes. But let's get it in perspective. I mean, 1,500 people, civilians, died in the course of the war. And, I mean, that figure could be achieved on a night or two in the Blitz in 1940-41. There were Zeppelins originally that came over. They had very limited range, so it was only really the eastern counties that were bombed. There was a famous raid in December 1914 on Whitby and Scarborough on the east coast of Yorkshire. There were raids on places like Lowestoft and Great Yarmouth, which were the easternmost point of the country. And they did manage to get through to London. It caused a great scandal because there was a network of Royal Flying Corps airfields, even early in the war, that were supposed to be defending London, and they were pretty hopeless at shooting down these enormous Zeppelins. Soon the RFC got the measure of the Zeppelins and the raids died down. But then the Germans invented the Gotha bomber, which was an aeroplane and which caused terrible problems, again, mainly in London in 1917 and 1918, notably bombing a school in the east end of London and killing about 200 children, which was an enormous proportion of the total civilians who died during the war. But there were sufficiently few bombing raids that when a Zeppelin was shot down, for example, in Essex in 1915, it became a great tourist attraction. The farmer whose field it dropped in until he was stopped from doing so charged sixpence a time for people to come and see it. So, yes, I mean, there was an attempt to destabilise the population by doing that, but it was quite quickly realised by the Germans, if you really wanted to destabilise the British people, you got rid of their food supplies. And indeed, there was a conversation between the Kaiser and one of his advisers early in 1917 that said, well, the winner of this war will be the country that starves last. And they determined then by restarting the U-boat war in early 1917. The U-boat war had been suspended after the Americans were angry with the sinking of the Lusitania 2 years earlier. When they started that U-boat war and started sinking our ships, that was the real attempt to starve us into submission. It failed, partly because of all those women growing crops in English agriculture, but also because it brought the Americans into the war, and that was decisive once the troops got to Europe in 1918.
You're quite critical of elements of the British government in the response to the war, particularly in 1918. Expand on some of those areas.
Well, Lloyd George, I think possibly quite rightly, had a low opinion of General Haig, or Field Marshal Haig. Lloyd George was horrified by the Somme, in whose planning he'd had no part. He became War Secretary a couple of days after the Battle of the Somme was launched. And he allowed himself to be bamboozled both into the Nivelle Offensive of the spring of 1917, which was really the Battle of Arras, and that was bad enough. But he was then further bamboozled by Haig into agreeing to what became the Battle of Passchendaele. Now, Haig wasn't to know that it was going to be the wettest summer in living memory in northern France and south Belgium, and therefore he wasn't prepared for the terrible mud bath that began at Passchendaele because of these torrential rains that lasted for weeks. And it bogged down the army and presented what should have been a mobile British army as effectively a sitting target for the German guns. So when we got to the beginning of 1918, the Russians had left the war. The Germans had concluded the Treaty of Brest-Litovsk with them after the Russian Revolution. And it became apparent to British intelligence, which was actually quite good during the Great War, that vast quantities, I think it was something like getting on for 40 divisions of German troops, were moving from the old Eastern Front to the Western Front. And Lloyd George was not only told by British intelligence that these divisions were on their way, he was also told that they were heading for a part of the line where the British line met the French line and was therefore possibly at its weakest, and that there would be an attack. And he was asked by Haig and was advised by some of his advisers in London that he should send as many British troops as possible out to the line to reinforce it. So young men of 18 who wouldn't normally have been asked to go and serve, people whose training could perhaps be cut short, soldiers home on leave, he was told to get them all out there. And he simply refused. And he refused for possibly the good reason that he didn't want Haig to murder all them in the way that Haig had murdered them at the Somme and at Passchendaele. What this meant, though, was that the line was woefully under-supported when the Germans attacked on the 21st of March 1918, and they got to within about 60 or 70 miles of Paris. They went over the Somme battlefield, which we'd fought over 4.5 months, in an afternoon. I mean, the land the Germans obtained was pretty useless. It was all shell holes and blown to smithereens and laid waste. But it did get them closer to the seat of the French government than they'd otherwise have been. And had a large number of American troops not arrived on the Western Front in June and July 1918 to help drive the Germans back, we would have been in serious trouble. What I objected to about Lloyd George was that when he was found to have made a mistake or a miscalculation in doing this, he refused to own up to it. He tried to blame everybody else, which was a favourite tactic of his, whereas he had quite clearly taken the responsibility to decide that those troops should not be sent out there. And when somebody objected, that person was General Morris, who was a soon-to-be forcibly retired member of the General Staff in London and a very gifted intelligence officer. When Morris pointed out that Lloyd George had lied to the House of Commons about the number of troops that were actually on the Western Front, Lloyd George had him thrown out of the army and tried to get his pension reduced, and again tried to blame everybody apart from himself for the error. Then to compound everything else, when the war was won, which was, I say, not least down to Americans coming into the fight, but also because of the huge success of the Royal Navy in blockading Germany into starvation, which, as had been predicted, you know, would finish them off, Lloyd George called himself the man who'd won the war. And in fact, Lloyd George was the man who very nearly lost the war. And eventually, this aspect of his reputation became well known, and it was not least responsible for the end of his time as Prime Minister late in 1922.
What about Britain? I mean, how did the war change Britain? You've mentioned, of course, the political realignment, but were there, you know, the losses suffered, the people talk about the sort of end of a patriarchal society, deferential society. Do you buy all that? How did British change instead of its sort of its ideological, its cultural makeup, do you think?
It was certainly the beginning of the end of a deferential society, because many people, you know, particularly ex-Tommies who'd spent 3 or 4 years up to their necks in mud in Flanders being shot at by Germans, did not have a high opinion of the political or military direction that had led to them being in that predicament. And so there was, to an extent, and I don't want to overstate it, there was, to an extent, a distrust and a lack of confidence in the old ruling class. But then you only have to go to any public school and look at the war memorials to see that the highest proportion of any demographic group in society to be killed in the Great War were young men from the middle and upper classes. Who died in huge quantities, leading men on the Western Front. So I think a lot of people who'd fought on the front recognised that the officer class had taken more than its share of casualties and fatalities in fighting the war. But when they got back, they weren't prepared to give the sort of trust and deference to their social superiors and to politicians that they'd been used to doing before. Also, one great part of the economy which began to decline severely with the outbreak of war and never really recovered afterwards, was those, I think, 4 million people before the war who were in service. Many men who went to fight on the Western Front said that they were never going to go back into service again. They weren't going to, you know, work in somebody's household and tug their forelock to them. And many women who had been in domestic service as parlourmaids or cooks or housemaids said, well, we're not doing it either. I mean, hence the, much in the 1920s written about the servant problem, even at times of high unemployment. So the notion of an upper middle class that was waited on hand and foot, that, apart from in very big houses, that really does come to an end after the war. And as I say, women become independent. Women start looking for ways to be successful without depending on their husbands. I mean, it's a long way to go. I mean, we, you know, we don't get to equal pay for women until the 1970s. But it's the start, I won't say of a feminist movement, but of an equality movement for women. And that does, I think, become quite a big deal. Finally, in 1917 and 18, while everyone's worrying about fighting the war, there are groups of people, notably in the House of Lords, led by people like Lord Haldane, and in the House of Commons by H.A.L. Fisher, the education minister, who are very concerned about how to improve education after the war, that they want more opportunity for everybody. They realise how very bad Britain has been at managing its human resources, in that many people capable of achieving a lot in education, capable of having an intelligence well developed by going to into a sixth form or going to university. These people are leaving school at 13 or 14 and having no chances at all. And it is recognised at the end of the war as part of a raft of welfare measures that include some sort of proto-health service and some sort of proto-social service, that it's absolutely important to ensure that we educate all our children better. So that too is about the breaking down of class barriers. It's about thinking that working class children and children at the lower end of the middle class have as much right to a decent education as people who in the past could afford to pay for it.
The Second World War looms so large in popular imaginations, the standing alone, the Blitz, the D-Day, various things. Do we remember, do the British people today, does the First World War mean anything? Do we remember it?
Do you know, it means a lot more than it did when I was a child 50 years ago. I can remember in the 1970s a state of almost complete disregard for the Great War. There were still a number of veterans alive then, of course. I mean, men then in their 80s and 90s. And, you know, it was almost, well, do we need to bother to keep going on with Armistice Day? And I think that one of the great changes in my lifetime has been when that last group of soldiers who had fought in the Great War died around the turn of this century, it suddenly focused minds of the British public that those people were gone and that there was no one left who'd actually gone through that ordeal of fighting in the trenches, and that it was important to try and envisage what they had gone through. And when one starts to do that, one realises the immense sacrifice that they made. You know, 880,000 British soldiers died in the war, plus about another 100,000 or so from the British Empire. And this was death and carnage on a scale that we cannot conceive of. I mean, quite rightly, if we lose a single soldier now in a foreign conflict, it appears on the news and we lament that fact. But when you consider that 19,026 men died on the first day of the Somme, it's something which we as a country now could not absorb. And it was only absorbed in 1916 by the fact that it was massaged and it was largely concealed from the public that a loss of that size had happened. So I think we've become very used to remembering the Great War in the last 20 or 30 years. And we've now also in tandem got, you know, the last people who fought in the Second World War are shortly no longer going to be with us. There's one man left now who fought in the Battle of Britain who's 101. And that quite rightly focuses our concentration on that fight for our freedom. But the Great War, I think, becomes or is seen to have been a really pivotal moment in our history. Of course, history isn't taught very well in schools. If I say, as I would, that there's no event really since the Reformation in Great Britain that is so far-reaching on society as the Great War. Many people who don't know what the Reformation is will wonder what I'm talking about. But certainly the Reformation is the only event between the Norman Conquest and 1914 that is of comparable significance. And I think as time goes on, and let's hope that history is better taught in schools and universities, that people will come to recognise just how that war changed society, but also what a massive act of sacrifice it was by us to have fought it, you know, in defence of a treaty to guarantee Belgian independence that had been sealed in 1839.
Absolutely. Simon Heffer, thank you very much. Your book is called?
My book is called Staring at God, Britain During the Great War.
Thank you very much indeed for coming on the podcast.
Thank you, Dan. It's been a great pleasure.
I feel the hand of history upon our shoulders.
All this tradition of ours, our school history, our songs, this part of the history of our country, all were gone and finished.
Hi everyone, it's me, Dan Snow. Just a quick request. It's so annoying and I hate it when other podcasts do this, but now I'm doing it and I hate myself. Please, please go onto iTunes, wherever you get your podcasts, and give us a 5-star rating and a review. It really helps and basically boosts up the chart, which is good. And then more people listen, which is nice. So if you could do that, I'd be very grateful. I understand if you don't want to subscribe to my TV channel. I understand if you don't want to buy my calendar, but this is free. Come on, do me a favor. Thanks.
How's it? My name is Les Eddy. I'm a tour leader with Explore. Come on, let me show you something. Oh, careful. Can you see it? Oh, trust me. It can see you. There. Between the trees. It's not every day you get to see a rhino on a walk. I guess not everyone is taken to the right places. But you will be. If you explore. For global adventures, search exploreworldwide.com and don't just travel. Explore.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Dan Snow's History It. Please follow this show wherever you get your podcasts. It really helps us and you'll be doing us a big favour. Don't forget you can also listen to all of these podcasts ad-free and watch hundreds of TV documentaries when you subscribe at historyhit.com/subscribe. As a special gift, you can also get your first 3 months for just £1 a month when you use code DANSNOW at checkout.